It's half past eight New York time. Time to wake up America and stump the experts. Each week at this time, Lucky Strike asks you to join its Information Please party. Here's how it goes. You furnish the questions and our experts try to answer them. For every question we use, Lucky Strike pays out $10 plus a copy of the new Information Please quiz book. If your question stumps us, you get $25 more, plus a 24-volume set of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Send your questions to Information Please, 480 Lexington Avenue, New York City. If our editorial staff edits your questions a bit, don't fret over it. In case of similarity, we'll have to be sole judge of who shall be paid. And all questions become the property of Information Please. And now light up a Lucky Strike as I present our Master of Ceremonies, book reviewer of the New Yorker magazine, Clifton Fadiman. Mr. Fadiman.
Ladies and gentlemen, as you know, we play this game without benefit of any preparation or rehearsal. The questions are answered or muffed quite off the bat. The batsman tonight consists of the eminent sports expert and author of the American sporting scene, John Kieran, the no less eminent poet and columnist, Franklin P. Adams, and the equally eminent Oscar Levant, composer and pianist. Our guest is the well-known author and educator, Dr. George N. Schuster, president of Hunter College in the city of New York. We'll begin with a question that comes from Willard Cheeseman of Arlington, Virginia. Now, gentlemen, I'm going to imagine that you are all sound asleep, a situation which has happened on this program on occasion, and we'll imagine that your sleep is interrupted by the following lines. Identify them for me. Get two out of three. The first is, wake up and live. Could you identify the line for us? What does it come from? Wake up and live. Mr. Kieran.
It's the title of a book.
It's the title of a book by Dorothea Brand. That's one answer. Mr. Levant, did you have another?
No, I was thinking of Awake and Sing.
You think about that for a minute. Did you have another, Dr. Schuster?
I'm sorry, I knew the title.
Is that an insurance ad?
No, it's a song, Mr. Levant, by Gordon and Revel. Don't mind.
I fell asleep during that song and didn't get up.
I'm sure I couldn't wake you up if I sang it. Don't mind the rainy patter, wake up and live, and you'll find it's mind over matter or something like that. Remember it now? But Miss Brand's book gave the phrase a kind of temporary immortality. Now, here's another waking up phrase. My lady sweet, arise. My lady sweet, arise. What would that mean to any of you gentlemen? Mr. Adams.
Hark, hark, the lake, the lark.
Yes.
At Heaven's Gate sing.
Yes, it's from what play, Mr. Kieran?
I think it's from Cymbeline.
Yes, I think it's from Shakespeare's Cymbeline. Now, suppose you were awakened by this. Ain't you shamed, you sleepy head? Ain't you shamed, you sleepy head? What would that mean to you, Mr. Adams?
That would mean R.L. Stevenson to me.
It would indeed. What's the poem from which I've been quoting?
Child's Garden of Verses.
That's the collection, yes. But can you give us the exact poem in which the phrase, ain't you shamed, you sleepy head, occurs?
Well, something came to windowsill.
Birdie, little birdie. birdie with a...
Yellow bill.
Very good. Yellow bill. Hopped upon a windowsill.
Hopped upon my windowsill.
Did what, then?
Something to his head and said, ain't you shamed, you sleepyhead.
It's cocked its shining eye and said, ain't you shamed, you sleepyhead. And if I said, finally, wake up, America, would that mean anything to you, gentlemen, Mr. Levant?
Is that Lucky Strike?
You bet it is. And it's time to stump the experts, which we'll perhaps do with the next question from Matthew J. Edwards of Brooklyn. Now, I'm going to give you four statements that are found in the American's Creed. That was drawn up, as you know, by William Tyler Page and adopted by the House of Representatives in April 3rd, 1918. Give me the source of these statements. I believe in the United States of America as a government of the people, by the people, for the people. That's the first phrase. Could we get the source of that, Dr. Schuster?
Of the people, by the people, for the people, of course, Abraham Lincoln.
Abraham Lincoln, and from what famous?
Gettysburg Address.
Famous Gettysburg Address. Now, here's the next phrase. Deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. Mr. Kieran.
That's from the Declaration of Independence.
Yes, generally ascribed to...
Thomas Jefferson.
Now, here's the third phrase. A more perfect union. A more perfect union. Dr. Schuster?
I think that comes from Lincoln, too.
No, I think not, though he may possibly have quoted the phrase somewhere in his speeches. Mr. Adams?
That's possibly from the Constitution of the United States.
Yes, it is.
From the preamble.
From the preamble to the Constitution. And finally, one and inseparable. Describing this more perfect union, Mr. Kieran.
That's from a speech of Daniel Webster in the United States Senate.
The famous...
One and inseparable, liberty and union, one and inseparable, now and forever.
Yes. Well, now, we got 3 out of 4 on that, and possibly Dr. Schuster may have been right in ascribing the more perfect union to... did you say that was from Lincoln? But until we learn to the contrary, I shall have to send $25 and a set of the encyclopedia to Mr. Edwards. Very well. Now, here's one from William T. Schaefer of Allentown, Pennsylvania. It's a musical question, but I think we can all get into this. It's not terribly difficult. There are 3 musical selections going to be played on the piano, one right after the other. How many people in all would sing these selections if you heard them in the theater?
Sing?
Sing, yes. How many people would sing them? You have to add up the number of people who'd sing them all and give me the sum. Now, these 3 selections will be played one after the other. Go ahead, Joe. I'm going to allow you gentlemen to work together on this to help each other out. Are you absolutely sure,
Mr. Durant? I'm sure of it.
Because if you don't get the sum correct, you know, you lose $25.
You don't lose it, but we lose it. I got it.
All right. Go ahead.
28.
That's right. Good for you.
Well, it's easy. You said it was easy before.
How'd you make it out?
20 maidens from patients.
Yes.
20, they're hoping for some fellow to come along.
Lovesick is the word.
Yeah. And the next is a duet from Porgy. That's 22.
Good work.
And the sextet from Lucia. 22, 23, 24, 25, 28.
You've got it. Yeah. Mr. Adams, had you worked it out?
I worked it out a good deal quicker.
Just didn't get your hand up quite as fast. Well, I didn't think it was as easy as all that. Apparently it was pretty easy. All right, how about this one from Paul J. Crowley of Rochester, New York. Get 2 out of 3 on this. What 2 battles occurred in the same place, first in France during the First World War? 2 battles in the First World War that occurred in the same place in France. What was that battle? Had the same name, of course. Mr. Kieran?
Battles of the Marne.
Yes, the first and second, both very famous and bloody battles of the Marne. Now, what 2 battles occurred in the same place during the Civil War in the United States? Dr. Schuster.
Bull Run.
Yes, first and second battles of Bull Run. And what 2 battles occurred in the same place during the Franco-Prussian War and the present world war?
I know that one.
Mr. Levant.
Sedan.
Sedan is right, yes. You boys are very good on your military history. Now, how about this one from Emily D. Denby of Norfolk, Virginia? Get 2 out of 3. What literary character chose a wife first to get an education? Chose a wife in order to get an education. Mr. Levant?
Oh, no, wait a minute. I was thinking of Barry's What Every Woman Knows, but that's not true.
Just keep thinking of it. That's correct.
Well, John Shan, he married...
Very good, yes.
Helen Hayes, if I remember.
You get more and more self-confidence as I encourage you. That's quite right, Mr. Levant. John Shan married his wife in What Every Woman Knows to get an education. Dr. Schuster, would you consider that an adequate substitute for college?
Indeed, I would.
What literary character chose a wife to win an election, in order to win an election? Mr. Levant.
Wintergreen and Of Thee I Sing.
Good enough. And what one chose a wife in order to get a new car? To get a new car.
Tobacco Road.
Tobacco Road, yes. Mm. Who was it that did that?
The boy who threw the ball against the fence all the time.
Yeah, Dude was his name?
Dude, yeah. Dude Lester.
Marries...
Sister Bessie.
Good work, Mr. Levant. Now, gentlemen, you made Mr. Levant carry that whole question on his own shoulders.
I made a study of marriage.
Are you now in the postgraduate phase, Mr. Levant?
I hope not.
Here's one from Rosaline Samfield of Memphis, Tennessee. Get 3 out of 4. Well, this is a kind of gag question. Name and describe these contradictions. For example, if I asked you to give me the name of a table without any legs, you would no doubt reply, the multiplication to add up, boy, Mr. Adams. Very good.
I wouldn't.
Well, now, how about a circus without clowns? A circus without clowns. Mr. Adams.
Circus Maximus.
The Circus Maximus in Rome, and or a flea circus would not have any clowns.
Or Piccadilly Circus.
Or Piccadilly Circus, yes. Very good. You see, it's very easy, Mr. Adams. Do you like this game?
I like that.
All right. How about a pie without a crust? Pie without a crust. Mr. Kieran.
Pie in a circle. The relation of the diameter to the circumference.
That's quite right. Yes, Mr.
Or
Adams?
Some jumbled type.
Yes, pied type. I don't think you can use the word pie by itself. Don't you usually say the type is pied?
They call it pie anyway.
They call it pie, Mr.
Isn't
Mr.
there Levine? Some Hawaiian delicacy
pie?
Poi. Poi. P-O-I. And don't describe it. It isn't even a delicacy for Hawaiians.
Hibernian pie.
Hibernian pie?
Poi.
Poi? Oh, I see what you mean. How about a dog without a tail? A dog without a tail. Can you think of a dog without a tail? Mr. Kieran.
Fire dogs.
Fire dogs, very good. Hot dogs.
Oh, yeah.
Similarly.
Yeah.
A door without keys. A door without keys.
You mean without a lock?
Without, in this case, no lock, no keys. No, hardly nothing.
The door to heaven.
That's pretty, but it might conceivably have keys. St. Peter, as a matter of fact, is usually thought of as holding the keys to the gate.
Oh, wait a minute. The open door.
Very good. The open door.
That's
yes.
in China, isn't it?
That's right. The open door policy in China. That's excellent. Very good. Now, so far, Lucky Strike has paid out only $25 and one set of the Encyclopedia Britannica. In olden times, poets, and Mr. Kieran could quote them all, no doubt, used to write about the divine herb, tobacco. But Mr. Cross says that our attitude today is, of course, more realistic.
That's right, ladies and gentlemen. It's the actual facts and figures about tobacco that are important today. For you know that in a cigarette, it's the tobacco that counts. So it's to your own interest to choose a cigarette you know is made of the milder, better-tasting leaf. Now, the proof that Lucky Strike means fine tobacco is contained in reports from tobacco markets all over the South. For example, here's one from Adel, Georgia. At auctions there this season, the American Tobacco Company paid 46% more for tobacco. Yes, 46% above the average market price published by the United States Department of Agriculture. And the best tobacco we buy goes into Lucky's. That's why Lucky Strike means fine tobacco. Mr. Fadiman, isn't that reason enough for smokers to try Lucky's?
Mr. Cross, you've amply justified the suggestion, and you took only 50 seconds. We'll go on with the second half of the program with a question from Helen Peck Young of Montclair, New Jersey, and get 2 out of 3, if you can, on this one. It's about the ring of a bell in various places. What was the significance of the ring of a bell in Macbeth? A bell is rung in Macbeth. Dr. Schuster.
Murder.
Murder is the significance. Who was going to murder whom?
Macbeth.
That's a
murder
fair...
of Duncan.
Yes, the murder of Duncan. And who
Hear
gave the signal?
Not Duncan, tis a knell.
Good enough.
It summons thee.
Go ahead. Summons
to
thee.
To heaven Mr. or to hell.
That's quite right. Mr. Levant?
I thought that the one, you know, that Macbeth murdered was killed before the bell rang.
No, Lady Macbeth rang the bell to give the signal for Macbeth to go in and kill Duncan.
They rang
also
a bell
murdered in sleep.
In the course of the play, there was a certain amount of sleep murdering. That's true.
Macbeth does murder sleep.
That's right. Very true. Very true. It's a little comic relief in the play. What was the significance of the ring of a bell in the Bell of Atri, or perhaps Atri, A-T-R-I? Does that come to you, Mr. Kieran?
I think that was rung by a donkey, wasn't it?
Make it a horse.
A horse. It summoned the people. Is that one of Longfellow's Tales of a Wayside
it
Inn?
It is indeed. That's very, very good. You have an excellent memory, Mr. Kieran. yes, it's the bell in the marketplace, which was supposed to be rung by anyone who had a grievance.
That's right. And this horse was ill-treated.
He was.
And rang the bell and thereby bettered his condition.
Good enough. That's right. That's the whole story, and it's to be found in Longfellow's Tales of the Wayside Inn. How about the ring of a bell in the poem, Tennyson's poem, In Memoriam? Does that come back to any of you? Mr. Adams?
Ring out, wild bell.
Yes, that's right.
Across the sky.
To the wild sky, yes. And that ringing out of the bell was to commemorate, to signalize what, Dr. Schuster?
Passing of the year.
The passing of the year is quite right. Ring out, wild bells, and let him die, meaning the old year. Well, we got 3 out of 3 on that. How about this from Herbert Goldstone of Forest Hills, New York? It's a sports question. Get 3 out of 4. In what sport does the playing area have the following measurements? Now, the first set of measurements is between 16 feet and 20 feet square. anywhere in between those. What sport would that suggest to you, Mr. Levant?
Is that handball?
Think not. That would be one wrong. How about it, Mr. Adams? Can you correct us? 16 feet, 20 feet square? It's between those two.
Sounds like standing room in a picture theater.
Mr. Kieran, you have looked at the boxing ring, I suppose, several thousand times.
Well, standard sizes, the old size used to be 24 feet.
We've shortened it.
You've got 16-foot ring. You're fighting midgets.
Well, this is a Reader's Digest version, I guess, of a boxing match. It says here between 16 and 20 feet square.
24-foot ring is a full-size concert grand ring.
Take me out.
Well, it may be for flyweights. I'm not sure. How about 41 inches by 60 feet? That would be the area that you'd play on in what sport?
41 inches.
41 inches by 60 feet. Dr. Schuster.
And that's a game of bowls.
Yes, it is. A game of bowling, yes. From the foul line to the number one pin is about 60 feet, and it's 41 inches wide, sometimes 42. How'd you happen to know that, Dr. Schuster? Are you a bowler by any chance?
By necessity, sir.
You have bowled in your day. How about 9 feet by 5 feet? The playing area would be for what sport?
Is that for paddle tennis?
Paddle tennis or ping pong? Is that what you mean?
No, I mean paddle tennis with a
with a net, with a large net in the open.
Sort of rubber.
No, it's table tennis.
Ping pong. He was right the first time.
If you mean ping pong or table tennis, I'll accept your answer as correct. That has a... Do you mean that?
Sure.
Or if you mean the tennis that's played with paddles in the open air over a large net lifted from the ground, I won't accept your answer.
He means ping pong.
I see that you and Dr. Schuster have struck up a pretty steady friendship.
I want to go to Hunter Crawford.
I guess he does mean ping pong, and that would be right. A table 9 feet by five is standard. How about 300 feet by 160 feet? Mr. Kieran.
A football field.
A football
intercollegiate.
Field.
Intercollegiate.
That's quite right. Although sometimes there's an additional area behind the goalposts, isn't there?
There always is.
End zone.
End zone, 30
10
feet.
Yards.
10 yards.
10 yards, yes, or 30 feet. How about this one from Mrs. Martha Fallquist of McKeesport, Pennsylvania? Get 3 out of 4. Supply the proper name which precedes each of these quotations. Supply the proper name, you understand, which precedes each of these quotations. The first is, blank, thou shouldst be living at this hour. England hath need of thee. Dr. Schuster.
Milton.
Milton, yes. The quotation is from what poem?
From Wordsworth's sonnet.
Yes, Wordsworth's beautiful sonnet on Milton. Blank was a liar and a fluent liar therewith. Blank was a liar and a fluent liar therewith. Mr. Kieran?
That's from Kipling.
It is indeed. Who's the liar?
I think it was Paget, M.P.
That's right. Paget, M.P. was a liar. That's very good going, Mr. Kieran. A fluent liar therewith. He spoke of the heat of India
as the Indian solar myth.
Very good, yes. That's not a very well-known poem of Kipling. How about blank when we were first acquaint? Blank, when we were first acquaint. Mr. Adams.
John Anderson.
John Anderson.
My Joe John.
John Anderson, My Joe John. From what poem is that?
John Anderson.
Who wrote it?
Probably Burns.
Burns is quite right. Okay. Now, how about... let's see. We got 3 out of 3 on that. Now, how about this one from Roger W. Holmes of South Hadley, Massachusetts? Get 2 out of 3 if you can. Now, this is a rather difficult musical question, I think. I want you to listen carefully. We're going to play a popular arrangement of each of 3 well-known classics. And what we want you to do is to trace the development from the original composition to the arrangement that is to be played. Is that clear, Mr. Levant? You'll probably be a top man on this. Is that clear to you?
Only time can tell. I don't know.
All right. We'll start in. Let's start in with the first, which is perhaps the easiest. Mr. Levant?
It's by Rudolf Fremmel, and I'll bet this is not on the card. It was originally in a Ziegfeld Follies of 19... I was a kid then, but I still hung around there. 1922.
But what is it?
Then it became...
What did?
It's by Fremmel. Then they used it. Herb Stothard adapted it. Is the donkey original title before
then
the
then it became
over.
1923.
Is that right so far?
Gee, you got me all mixed up.
Oh, no, I'm all wrong. That's Tchaikovsky.
That's right.
That's the Andante Cantabile from the string quartet of Tchaikovsky, who was not in the Ziegfeld Follies of 1923.
Now, you want to go back over all that whole story? Now, what arrangement was being played by Joe at the pianist?
Well, there's no copyright on that. They can play any arrangement they like. There have been 5,000 versions of
but
that.
But did you recognize this particular one?
Tchaikovsky.
Originally.
Well, there was a song hit last year. I think it may have been not ASCAP. I don't know if I listened to it or not.
Well, I'm afraid I can't give you full credit on that.
All right.
What was being played was Kostolanitz's, what shall we say?
Come to Me, Kostolanitz.
Kostolanitz's excision of part of the melody of the Andante Cantabile String Quartet of Tchaikovsky.
Well, why call it Kostolanitz? Anybody can do it, and a lot of people have done
it. Don't tell that to Kostolanitz.
I tell it to him now.
I think I'll have to give you an imperfect on that, and that's the easiest one.
It may be easy for Kostolanitz.
Now let's have the second. Second popular arrangement. Mr. Levant has his hand up.
Well, John said it was Strauss. That's the Blue Danube. That arrangement for one piano, Michel Levitsky used to play it very well. It was by Schultz Evler.
Yes, but it wasn't
not a baseball combination.
Piano. Huh? Did you notice how many pianos were playing it behind you there?
Obviously, two.
With
four hands.
Who arranged it for two pianos?
Not these two fellas.
No, though no doubt they could have.
Wait a minute. I think it might have been Chasen's.
I'm
not sure.
Yes. Well, that gives us the whole story. It's Chasen's arrangement, based on this arrangement for one piano by Schultz Ebler, based on the original melody, Mr. Kieran, by...
Strauss.
By Strauss, yes.
Strauss.
We haven't named the melody, have we?
Blue Danube.
The Blue Danube. And now the third and last. That little locomotive Walt Disney touched was Mr. Levant's own contribution.
That's La Campanella, which I wouldn't advise you to play if you're drunk.
It has a lot of skips.
It's originally by Paganini for the violin. Liszt made a transcription. And then since that time, Busoni, who could do anything, and who could be bored by the most difficult piece, which that is, he made an added transcription.
That's right. And that was the one that was being played by our studio pianist. That's very good going, Mr. Levant. Thank you very much. You know, Mr. Kieran, you had a knowing look on your face. Did you know all that?
Only Strauss.
How about this one from Gibson Adams of Indianapolis? Yet two out of three. This is about famous travelers. Who traveled on land for 40 years? Traveled on land for 40 years. Mr. Kieran.
How long did it take Moses to...
40 years. That's right. Moses and the children of Israel. Moses was 80 when he started, and 120 when they sighted the Holy Land. That makes 40 years. Now,
seems like yesterday.
Who traveled on the sea for 2 months and 9 days? These are not necessarily imaginary characters. Mr. Kieran?
Columbus.
Columbus is right, yes, from August 3rd to October 12th, 1492. Now, who traveled in the air for 7 hours, 28 minutes, 25 seconds?
You mean traveled... I've been in the air that long.
Pardon?
I've been in the air that long.
You've been in the air for longer than that. Who traveled in the air for... This is obviously an aeronautical question.
That is
Charles A. Lindbergh.
No.
The man who makes pictures that are around the record.
That's right.
Hughes.
Yeah, yes. Howard
Charles
Hughes.
Evans Hughes.
Yes, Howard Hughes. Howard Hughes, who crossed the continent from Burbank, California, to Newark. Here's one from Miss Paget Sweeney of this city, New York City. What do the authors of the following well-known works of literature have in common? The first work is The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. The second work is The Good Earth. The third work is Mrs. Dalloway. The fourth work is The Essays of Elia. The authors of those have what in common, Mr. Adams?
Animal names.
Animal names, yes. Can you give us the names?
Mm-hmm.
The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. How about
Gibbon.
Gibbon. And what is a gibbon, Mr. Adams?
Don't point at me, Mr. Adams.
I don't know. It's something in Malay in a crossword puzzle.
Mr. Kieran?
It's one of the monkey primate type.
That's right. Yes, that's right. And the author of The Good Earth?
Buck.
Of the Mrs. Dalloway?
Wolf.
Yes, Virginia Woolf. Don't woof that name. And of the Essays of Ilya?
Lamb.
Yes, Charles Lamb. That's right. They're all animal names. Well, we got through very nicely on that. And now Mr. Cross points out that actions speak very much louder than advertising.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, what is said about any cigarette is really unimportant compared to what kind of tobacco is bought for it. At least that's what the makers of Lucky's have always believed. And a glance at the figures proves this. If Lucky's came from the factory to your cigarette counter without benefit of any advertising at all, the price you pay for a package of Lucky's would not be reduced one iota. You see, the total cost of all our advertising activities, radio, magazine, and newspaper, is such a small fraction of a cent a package that, even if it were entirely eliminated, the saving per package could not be passed on to you. And, ladies and gentlemen, that's significant, because you know, if you stop to think of it, that in a cigarette, it's the tobacco that counts. The tobacco, not the advertising. And at markets all over the South, the American Tobacco Company consistently pays what it costs to get the milder, better-tasting leaf for Lucky's. For instance, this season at Fairmont, North Carolina, we paid 26% more than the average market price published by the United States Department of Agriculture. 34% more at Conway, South Carolina, and so on all over the South. And the best tobacco we buy goes into Lucky's. The result is that Lucky Strike means fine tobacco. Why not make your next package Lucky's and see for yourself?
Thank you, Mr. Cross. This evening, Lucky Strike has cheerfully paid out only $25 and one set of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Lucky Strike thanks you, Dr. Schuster, for your part in the party tonight. And next week, Mr. Kieran and Mr. Adams will be present. And our guests will be the novelist, poet, and lecturer, Miss Jan Struther, and the former ambassador to Russia, now chairman of the President's Committee on War Relief Agencies, Mr. Joseph C. Davies. Now remember, listeners, for every question that we use, whether or not it's answered correctly, the sender gets the sum of $10. And if the question should happen to stump our experts, which does happen, you not only get $25 more, but in addition, the complete 24-volume set of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Please remember to send your letters with questions and the correct answers to Information, Please, at 480 Lexington Avenue, New York City. And now, we'll listen to a parting message from Mr. L.A. Speed Riggs, famous tobacco auctioneer from Goldsboro, North Carolina.
When you hear that chant, ladies and gentlemen, remember that in a cigarette, it's the tobacco that counts, and Lucky Strike means fine tobacco. By the way, have you seen the new Lucky Strike gift chest? 500 Luckies in flat 50s and 20s, packed in a handsome natural grain sycamore chest. It's an ideal Christmas present for anyone you specially want to please. Ask to see it tomorrow at your favorite cigarette counter.
This is the National Broadcasting Company.